Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yes. Kia ora, Ellen. How are you doing?
Hi, Bronnie. Doing well.
Great. I'm loving the shirt, by the way. I know other people can't see you, but we've got Ellen here on Skype. He's got a great periodic table shirt.
There we go.
Very on brand. Now, unfortunately, we're not starting quite with the chemistry topic yet, though. Our first
one
is a bit of more of a public health concern, which is a study linking cannabis use to pregnancy during pregnancy to autism risk. Now, I thought this was a really interesting one because my sister's actually doing her PhD in neuroscience and focusing on autism. So I talked to her about this morning, and she reminded me of one thing, which is that, I mean, autism, when we're talking about it, is not just one thing, right? It's a spectrum. So it's got lots of underlying causes and factors, and some of these are unknown, which is part of the mystery. So how does this research help us with that?
Well, you know, it's all very interesting. So basically, the guts of the study was that this is done in Canada. And so what they have found out, the results basically first, was that children that are born to mothers who report using cannabis during pregnancy have got roughly a 50% greater risk of developing autism. So here's what they did. So these Canadian researchers studied around about half a million live births in Ontario from the years 2007 to 2012. And they then followed up the children until 2017. So, you know, it's a pretty good sample size. Of these 500,000 live births, there were around about 3,000 mothers who self-reported using cannabis while they were pregnant. And so the results were published earlier this month in the rather prestigious journal Nature Medicine. And so the results were that 2.2% of the children whose mothers used cannabis during pregnancy developed autism, or again, what they called autism. And that compares with around about 1.4% of children born to mothers who did not use cannabis. So, you know, that seems to be a significant difference, 2.2% versus 1.4%. And, you know, what really amazed me was, 1.4% of live births result in autism. That sounds to me like an enormously high number. I didn't know that, I guess, autism was so prevalent. That's quite scary, actually. Mm. Now, what they have to do, obviously, in any sort of medical study is to correct for, you know, environmental factors, et cetera, et cetera. So what they then did, having obtained these results, was then that they matched the mothers who had been using cannabis during pregnancy with those who didn't, who were of similar age, similar socioeconomic circumstances, similar health conditions, all of that sort of stuff, which, you know, you obviously have to do in a study like this. And once they took account of all of those factors, their final result, the final number, which is what everybody wants to know in a study like this, was that there was a 51% greater risk of developing autism if you use cannabis while you were pregnant. And that, again, you know, that's a big number to me anyway. You know, I think that's a significantly higher risk factor.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously there would have been some, a few margins of error, especially I feel like with the problem of self-reporting, because as they noted in the article, some people might be reluctant to admit to cannabis use, and also something else my sister pointed out is people who use cannabis may also be more likely to use other recreational drugs, which they might not have disclosed in the...
Right, and you know, and this is the problem with pretty much every medical study out there that is relying on sort of a survey type thing where you're looking at people to, you know, give you honest answers about what they've been doing. And, you know, this is recognized by people who've looked at this study. And one of the factors that they have brought up is that they said that those mothers who use cannabis are generally at higher risk of having mental health problems. And they could be using cannabis to self-medicate in this case. Now, apparently there is a genetic disposition to autism. And so therefore it could be that in this case, or that in some of these cases anyway, that the mothers are genetically passing on autism, and that the cannabis that they're using to self-medicate has nothing to do with it. And it was acknowledged that the study couldn't sort of rule this particular factor out. I guess on the other hand, there's been sort of lots of animal studies out there that show that use of cannabis can deleteriously affect the developing brain. And so, you know, these results would agree with those particular observations. So, you know, as I say, what people want out of a study like this is a definite answer. You know, you want to know, you know, yes, it's absolutely, you know, you will have a higher chance of getting autism, of having a baby that's got autism if you use cannabis. And very, very rarely do you get such a definitive answer out of studies like these, because studies like these involve human beings, and human beings are human beings. And, you know, as you say, the whole self-reporting thing, they could be using other recreational drugs, which again could have an impact on the developing fetus and stuff like that. So, you know, I hate to sound, what's the word? Kind of cheeky, I guess, but, you know, this is one of these things where further research is obviously required, even though we've got a 500,000 sample size. And one of the points that was brought up about this study was that in the USA, in the states where it's legal, and also in Canada, that often cannabis is touted as a cure or a treatment, I guess, for morning sickness. And I think that the results of this study might perhaps make people think twice about that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, definitely, I think that as we approach the referendum this year, if we're looking into legalization, how this could help us better understand and control such side effects. And maybe it just needs to be the case that, you know, consumption of cannabis comes with health warnings, just like alcohol. You're not supposed to consume alcohol when you're pregnant.
And you know, you've got to err on the side of caution here, don't you? Surely, you know, this study seems to sort of make it pretty plain that there are some very possible health risks here. And, you know, I totally agree. If it's going to be legalized, then stuff like this has to be taken into account. And yes, by all means, put sort of health warnings on, you know, on the labels and stuff like that. I think that would be a very, very sensible idea. But funnily enough, I haven't really seen much in the media or heard much in the media about this particular story. And I thought it might have made a little bit more impact than it has done. Again, as you say, given the fact that we have got a referendum coming up on this.
Yeah, certainly good for everyone to be informed, I guess, and to hear all the possible.
Absolutely. Yes. Yep.
Now, before we move on to our next question, I do know that just last week we got a question because we're talking about vaccines, about the link between autism and vaccines, which my sister also responded to, and I'm sure you may well want to as well. But what she noted was that autism spectrum disorder is caused by something that happens before birth, whether that's a gene mutation or another genetic factor, or like in this case, something that the mother took while pregnant, and because that's where those developmental differences start. So therefore, there can't be a link between autism and vaccines, because vaccines are delivered well after the babies are born. Did you have anything to add on that point?
Amen is what I would say to that. That particular paper by that guy, Andrew Wakefield, who has been disbarred as a doctor and all of that, and his paper that he published in The Lancet, to its everlasting shame, was basically shown to be completely wrong. It's been rejected from the paper now. It's been taken out. I really don't have any particular words for that guy. What he started is just wrong. It's just wrong with a capital W. So,
So to turn into something a bit more lighthearted, a bit more crazy, we've got these water beetles that can live on after being eaten and excreted by a frog. I mean, how do they survive that?
Look, I mean, I'm a chemist, and I work with totally inanimate objects in the lab and stuff like that. And so it always amuses me that people study some of the things that they do in other areas of science. And, you know, so I guess somebody's got to study frogs and what they eat, and, you know, that's fantastic. So there's a bunch of researchers at Kobe University in Japan, and they were interested in a particular type of frog and what the frog eats, obviously. And I think these were sort of endemic to the rice paddies, both the frogs and these water beetles. And so they have come across the first example, the very first observed example of a prey escaping out of a predator's bum, which I think is just fantastic. So there is a water beetle in Japan called, forgive my pronunciation, Regimbartia attenuata. And so this water beetle was observed in 30 experiments with a frog, 90% of the time to be able to get out of the frog's backside, okay? And so ordinarily, you know, when a frog eats something, it gets into the stomach, it's dissolved in the digestive juices, it's probably a horrible ending and stuff like that. The frog doesn't have any teeth to sort of crunch it up, so it's sort of relying on its digestive system to do all of this. However, this particular water beetle has got a very, very, very strong exoskeleton. And what that appears to do is to make it impervious to all of those digestive juices of the frog. So instead of dying down there, what it does, so it sort of slides down the throat, swims through the stomach, slides along the intestine, and comes out the backside. And so what makes it able to do that is, as I say, it's two things. It's the very, very strong exoskeleton. So that's impervious to all of these digestive juices. And also the fact that it is a water beetle means that it's used to living under water. And the way that it does that is that it traps little bubbles of air under its wings. And so therefore, once it's down in the digestive tract and all of that, where there's not a lot of air and stuff, it can still survive by living on those little bubbles of air that it's got under its wings. So as I said, there were 30 experiments, 90% of these water beetles actually ended up living. The average time that was inside the frog was a whopping 6 hours, which you know, that's quite extraordinary, I would have said. Although there was one very, very fast little critter that managed to get out in 6 minutes. So
speedy. Now, I understand that this is great news for the water beetles. I mean, good on them. But I wonder, how is this useful from an ecosystem point of view? I mean, doesn't it kind of mess with the food chain if the frogs are going through all the effort to catch this prey and then not getting any of the nutrition out of it?
Well, it's kind of interesting. You would think that somewhere along the line there's going to be some adaptation, by the frogs, and they're going to realize that, you know, they're not getting what they need out of these things, and they'll probably start avoiding them. You would imagine, you know, that would be the Darwinian response, I would think. So, again, a situation where more research is required, obviously.
Yeah. All right, then we'll turn for the last couple of minutes. We've just got this last story on a rare element, astatine. Now, did I pronounce that correctly?
You did.
Oh,
you did.
Great.
Very good.
Now, so what is this? Because I know the article calls it the rarest naturally occurring element on Earth, but you seem to express some doubts about that.
Well, it depends on who you believe and which book you read and stuff like that. But there is no doubt that this is an extraordinarily rare occurring element. Okay, so at any time on Earth, it is estimated, and I don't know how they do these estimates, that there might be around about 25 grams of it on the Earth. At any one time,
wow.
Yeah. That's not a lot. Not a lot. And the element that it shares this with is an element called francium. So those are the two sort of most, least abundant naturally occurring elements on Earth. So why are we suddenly interested in astatine? Well, researchers over in Europe at CERN, which is the home of the Super Collider, have been doing some experiments on astatine. They've been doing these experiments over about a decade, which does seem an awfully long time to study a particular element just to get one particular number out of it, which is the result of all this. The reason that they're studying, or one of the reasons why they're studying astatine, well, it's incredibly rare, so it's very, very difficult to study. But what they also were looking at it for is that it does have a possible use in cancer treatment. So it's a radioactive element. All of its isotopes are radioactive. It means they decay away pretty quickly. The longest lived isotope of astatine has a half-life of around about 8 hours. So after 8 hours, half of it's gone. And then the next 8 hours, the next half of it's gone, et cetera, which is why it's not abundant at all.
And okay? What makes it, I imagine, extremely difficult to study?
Oh, very much so, yes. And so they have to make it in the lab in batches and study it very, very quickly. And what they want to find is how avidly does it chew up an electron? Because Astatine is part of the group in the periodic table called the halogens, and you'll have heard of chlorine and fluorine and bromine and iodine. Astatine is the next one below them, and they all have in common the fact that they really, really, really like to grab one electron and make a negative ion. And so just how much they want to grab this one electron can have some effects on the properties of the product when they grab that electron and form the chloride ion or the iodide ion, and in this case, the astatide ion. So they're interested in it, as I say, from sort of this very possible cancer treatment point of view. They want to make sure that the astatide ion isn't going to interact sort of badly with healthy cells, that if we could use it to treat cancer, it's only going to go for the cancerous cells. And so as a result of that, they finally got this number out. This number is 2.41579 electron volts, and that number took about 10 years, apparently, to get. So as a result of having got that number, they can now hopefully do some more work on astatine and see if it does have a future as a possible cancer treatment or a cancer therapeutic agent.
But probably another couple of years before we
Oh, yes. Yeah. Another couple of years and another few million dollars. Oh, yes. Oh, very much so, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. We'll see you back here in a fortnight, I guess, hopefully in person, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yes, please. That'll be cool. Okay, take care, everybody.
See ya. And for everyone listening in, we'll be right back after this.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology. A lot of